Very near my setting sun, I bless you, life, because you never gave me neither unfilled hope, nor unfair work, nor undeserved sorrow and pain.
Muy cerca de mi ocaso, yo te bendigo, vida, porque nunca me diste ni esperanza fallida, ni trabajos injustos, ni pena inmerecida.
Because I see at the end of my rough way that I was the architect of my own destiny. And if I extracted the sweetness or the bitterness of things, it was because I put the sweetness or the bitterness in them. Mm-hmm. When I planted rose bushes, I always harvested roses.
Porque veo al final de mi rudo camino que yo fui el arquitecto de mi propio destino. Que si extraje las mieles o la hiel de las cosas, fue porque en ellas puse hiel o mieles sabrosas. Cuando planté rosales, coseché siempre rosas.
Certainly, winter is going to follow my youth. But you didn't tell me that May was eternal.
Cierto, a mis lozanías va a seguir el invierno. Mas tú nunca me dijiste que mayo fuese eterno.
I found, without a doubt, long my nights of pain. But you didn't promise me only good nights. In exchange, I had some peaceful ones.
Hallé, sin duda, largas las noches de mis penas. Mas no me prometiste tan solo noches buenas. Y en cambio, tuve algunas santamente serenas.
I loved. I was loved. The sun caressed my face. Life, you owe me nothing. Life, we are at peace.
Amé. Fui amado. El sol acarició mi faz. Vida, no me debes nada. Vida, estamos en paz.
Gracias, Carlos. What an outlook. Almost Buddhist in its acceptance of life's gifts. Its serenity at what many of us consider to be the mixed blessing of aging. Its calm understanding that human existence involves pain and peace. How does one get to such a place? Charles provided this poem, and when I first read it, I thought, how un-American it sounds. If you spend some quality time with your TV or your popular magazine, you may become convinced that the month of May might not be eternal, but it darned well should be. And not an unseasonably nasty or rainy May either. Happiness, bounding through life with a Diet Coke or a Bud Light in our hand, appears to be what is promised to us. We won't get old if we do that stuff either. And if we don't get what we deserve, we have a right to be unhappy. Accepting pain and difficulty is not a particularly American way of life. If we are persuaded that our little consumer selves should have all the things that we want, doggone it, and that these things will bring us unbroken happiness and the youth of the people in the advertising, how are we likely to feel about death? Well, not very enthusiastic. By and large, as a society, we don't really acknowledge it. We almost act as though it's not what it is. We embalm our dearly departed, make them up to look as if they're just sleeping, and bury them in big, expensive metal boxes guaranteed not to let moisture in. We have no societal rituals honoring the grieving and the celebrating that goes on for a very, very long time after someone we love dies. This is definitely not the road to the poet's peace with life and with death. Now, I'm going to leave the road of critique, and perhaps we can take it up again in some Occupy event, and move into the joy of what we celebrate today. That brings me to the bling and the glitter in my hair and the lots of jewelry. Almost parenthetically, though, while I stand by the critique of American society in general, it's also really important for me to realize that I am speaking to you, the dearly beloved of this community, and that many of us have gone through many deaths together. We have gone through them as Norteamericanos, as North Americans, but here, in this place, we have also partaken a little bit of the hilarity and the mirthful reverence that characterizes Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead celebration. And just, again, parenthetically, it's not celebrated by every single Mexican. Carlos, my poetry reader there, Charles, was reared in Mexico, and his family did not celebrate it. But many, many Mexicans do. I wish we could do more. I wish that we could, as a people, move towards celebrating our departed in such a way that it makes death truly a part of life. And I strongly encourage you to attend the Dia de los Muertos party on Wednesday. It will celebrate that. Now, if we were to transport ourselves into a Mexican town's celebration of Dia de los Muertos, one of the first things we would see would be a whole lot of skeletons and a whole lot of skulls, by and large depictions, not the real thing. Bright colors would riot with each other, gold and red and blue and purple and chartreuse and magenta and yellow and whatever. Skeletons called Katrinas, dressed up like society ladies, we would see them. We would see skeletons eating lunch together. Skeletons hanging around with each other, skeletons dancing, skeletons just doing stuff that people do when they're alive. We might see skulls made of marigold petals. I have marigolds here. This is the flower that attracts the spirit of the dead. And there's lots and lots of marigolds in the towns that celebrate the Day of the Dead. If we wander past a graveyard, we see families picnicking, cleaning their familial grave sites, placing food and drink on them to be hospitable to the spirits who will visit. If we're lucky enough to be invited into homes, we will see colorful, overflowing ofrendas decorated with the food and drink and things that the departed loved, welcoming them for their yearly visit. One site tells us, "The Aztec, Mayan, and other indigenous traditions have enriched the Mexicans' attitude about death. From these ancestors has come the knowledge that souls continue to exist after death, resting placidly in Mictlan, the land of the dead, not for judgment or resurrection, but for the day each year when they can return home and visit their loved ones." Color and joy and reverence abound. And the reverence isn't a Protestant, dark-hued solemnity, but it's a more boisterous and complete attitude of love and grief and hope and connection over and beyond time. The ongoing, reverent, joyful love of the ancestors makes life whole because it includes death every single year in a respectful, loving, and celebratory way. My guess is that the attitude behind those practices makes our poem's completeness possible. Now, I'd like to take the rest of my sermonic time to indulge in one of the great practices of Day of the Dead, telling stories about folks who have died. I asked for stories from you, and I got so many, way, way more than I can use in speaking today. But I have included every single one as it came to me in an addendum to the manuscript. There's always a copy of the sermon manuscript in the North Vestibule. This one has a multi-page addendum of wonderful stories from people in our congregation, and you may want to read them and be delighted as I was. In some of the stories, we hear about old-timers and their values and what they cherished. Bessie Labuddy's dad, who was reared in poverty in the rural south of our country, loved oranges and associated them with Christmas. Every year, when he was an adult with children of his own, the week before Christmas, he came home with a whole sack of oranges. And after dinner every night, the kids then would gather around, and he would cut them in wedges for them. He called them rashers. Debbie Espin's grandfather, probably also of this generation that didn't have very much, he once told his son, Debbie's father, about watching a man load sack after sack of groceries into his car, and he said, "He must have spent $10. It's a relative thing. Diane Barrero Lowe's mom was an old-fashioned Catholic, the kind with just a touch of superstition around the edges. And she would put a cup of holy water, at least she told her kids it was holy water, I'm not quite sure where she would get it, but anyway, she put a cup of holy water in the corner of each of her children's bedrooms to keep the evil spirits away. Well, unfortunately, the kids understood a lot more about evil spirits than they did about the magic of holy water, and became well and truly terrified of the dark to this day. Wanda Jennings speaks of her father's patriotism and of how kind he was to his children. When they were learning how to cook and they would burn things, he would sit down to the table and eat every single mouthful with gusto and say, "Nothing wrong with a little burned food." And the kids felt very affirmed. In the story, there are touching stories, stories that make us laugh and make us cry and tell us so much about the dead person. Sam McGinnis's dad had been around cars and engines his whole life. On his deathbed in the hospital, gripped by the very real fear that the medical establishment would not let him die in peace, he would whisper fiercely to Sam, "Don't let them start me up again." Eric Wallace speaks of his deceased wife. Many of us remember Linda. He says this: "Just a few weeks before she died, seriously ill from cancer, suffering from all the debilitating side effects of treatment, and suddenly, terribly, now also afflicted with West Nile virus, my dear Linda was still able to surprise me on my birthday. I had gone out to do errands. Jennifer Thomas was sitting at our house with Linda, who was 90% couch or bedridden. When I returned, there was a wonderful and familiar aroma in the air. I found Linda standing, leaning on the kitchen counter, assisted by Jennifer. Linda had just baked a big batch of my favorite currant scones. She apologized for their being burned, which they were, but who cared, and wished me a happy birthday. I burst into tears at her love, generosity, and courage. Linda's scones were the most moving birthday gift I've ever had." Sometimes our memories are colored by a genuine connection that transcends the grave. Bev Harley says about hearing first of her friend James Crouch's death. She says this: the day after I received the news of James' death, I woke up with a song singing clearly in my head. I can see clearly now, the pain is gone. She realized later that it's rain, but pain is what came to her. And she goes on to say, although I was sad, I believe that James sent me that song to let me know he was just fine now. A lot of us knew Judy McReynolds. She was a psychic. She was a matter-of-fact, vibrant woman who died of cancer about 6 years ago. Her sister, Mary Grant, writes this. One day, while caring for her, George, who was Judy's partner, said, where are all of these little stars that we're finding all over the floor coming from? Judy's response was that the angels were leaving them. Me, now this is Mary talking, her sister, me being a skeptic, thought they must be falling out of the many cards that she was receiving daily. After her death, I was the executor of her estate, and as I was leaving the house the day before it was to be sold, I found a small gold star beside my car. My first thought was, I can't get rid of these things. And then on my way home, I realized that the star was from my sister, and that she was thanking me for all of my hard work. Over the past 6 years, I have received at least 25 stars. They have been in strange places, like my makeup bag, in my couch, on the floor, in my car. I have kept all the stars and keep a journal of where and when I find them. Thank you, Judy, for being there for me. It is said that our first death is the dying. Our second is being lowered into the ground. The third is when there is no one left on earth who remembers us. And so we tell these stories to keep alive the memories, to keep alive these wonderful, flawed, funny, noble human beings. And we tell them so that we may remember that life has so many facets to it, so many quirks, so many tears, and so much laughter. That with luck, we will all grow old and then die, and that death is a part of life and of living. I want to close with a story about Mom, my lively mom. As many of you know, she and I had an up and down relationship sometimes in our life, but man, Mom was very full of life. She was a single mother in her late 30s at the time of this little event. I was about 15. Kate was about 13, Ginny would have been about 8, and Arthur about 7. We were all at a PTA meeting of the younger kids' elementary school because Ginny was receiving some sort of award. There was a woman we didn't know sitting on the aisle. People were talking up here. Mom was sitting to her right, and then us four kids were in a row to Mom's right, like that. Part of the preliminaries involved an announcement that Mrs. So-and-so was attending a meeting in New York paid for by our PTA. Well, Mother had very strong feelings about the better things that could be done with that money, and she snorted a very loud, unambiguous, unladylike kind of noise. All four of us swung our heads immediately toward her in mortified embarrassment. Without missing a beat, she swung her head with a judgmental look on her face to the lady who was to her left. The woman was so flummoxed and indignant that everyone in the room thought she was the snorter. We all got the giggles so badly. We almost had to leave. And that was my mom, full of life and quick on her mental feet, contributing so many times to uncontrollable giggles in our family. Charles, let's do a couple more lines of this poem one more time to remind us all of what it's about. I loved, I was loved. The sun caressed my face. Life, you owe me nothing. Life, we are at peace.
Amé, fui amado. El sol acarició mi faz. Vida, nada me debes. Vida, estamos en paz. Yeah.